The North Carolina Reading Service presents the following program for our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners. It's the Independent Indie Week. This weekly issue, read by John Federson today, is dated August the 14th of 2025. Our musicians will return shortly, that is to say at the end of our broadcast. And we'll start off in Durham with two or three articles at the very beginning, one a very major article in terms of length, and we'll get right to it now. First, the People's Alliance, PAC, makes Durham municipal election endorsements. Political hopefuls in the upcoming municipal elections got their first major endorsements last night during the People's Alliance PAC meeting. Over 230 members attended the virtual meeting, endorsing Matt Kopak in Ward 1, Shanetta Burris in Ward 2, Chelsea Cook in Ward 3, and Leonardo Williams for mayor. Candidates who attended the meeting were exiled to a breakout room while members discussed the candidates and voted for their picks. Kopak won in a crowded field, beating out five other candidates, including incumbent City Council member Didriana Freeman. According to a PA press release, members cited Kopak's, quote, strengths as an active listener and experience in environmental advocacy and local governments, as well as his work in climate neutrality and youth programs. The PA endorsed Freeman when she first ran for the seat in 2017 against then-incumbent Cora Cole McFadden, but chose Freeman's opponent, Marion Johnson, in 21. In Ward 2, the PA endorsed another challenger, Shanetta Burris, who nudged out Mayor Pro Tem Mark Anthony Middleton and Ashley Robinson. Burris has served in leadership roles with the Durham Committee, Durham CAN, and North Carolina Central University, her alma mater. During her tenure on City Council, Cook, a legal aid attorney, has advocated for affordable housing through her decisions at City Hall. People's Alliance is a longstanding and influential progressive political organization comprising the People's Alliance Fund. That's a 501c3 nonprofit that fundraises and supports educational and service programs. The Durham People's Alliance, a 501c4, focused on issues, advocacy, and partnership engagement, and the People's Alliance PAC, which prioritizes electoral politics and uplifting candidates who will further the progressive causes important to the PA. The endorsements weigh heavily amongst many Durham voters, not just PA members. Nana Asante-Smith, PAC coordinator since 2017, says our focus, as the PAC is, on providing, executing, and overseeing a process that informs, empowers, and is democratic. So that means facilitating collection and dissemination of information for voters and members of our community who share the mission and vision that the PA has, so that they can democratically and within their autonomy make their own decisions. An action team made up of PA members from different backgrounds gathers research on candidates and develops a questionnaire. They also host a candidate mixer that's open to the public, as well as conduct individual interviews with candidates following this questionnaire. The team submits its recommendation to the wider membership, a process meant to provide as much information as possible before members cast their vote at the endorsement meeting. Robust debate ensues before the convening members make their picks. Ultimately, the PAC coordinators provide the information, but it's the members who are the driving force behind these endorsements. For Kopak, the PA endorsement is a significant early victory, especially as a challenger. He says he feels overwhelmed by the support from an organization that is, quote, rooted in deep care for the community and making a difference in people's lives. He also says the democratic, member-driven process makes the results unpredictable, saying, almost every cycle, you have a situation where someone is recommended by the committee, and then the people who come to organize and vote select somebody else. PA members are not beholden to recommendations of that steering committee, but they are discouraged from campaigning against the PAC's preferred candidate once endorsements are finalized, an issue that PAC was forced to confront in 2020 when a group of rogue members circulated unsanctioned messaging in favor of someone other than the PA-approved candidate. Still, the unpredictability gives members and candidates confidence in the process. Asante Smith said, here's the thing about democracy, right? Democracy doesn't guarantee a particular result. However, democracy, when executed properly, ensures accessibility to the process. It ensures that everyone who wishes to participate can participate. And a reminder, finally, that early voting begins September 18th. That's just about a month from now. The primary election will be held October 7th. Two mayoral candidates and six city council candidates, two from each ward, will move forward from the primary to the general election on November the 4th. Next, two environmental articles. One is our longest article of the day. First, economic environmental ripple effects are feared from potential EPA downsizing in North Carolina. As the Trump administration keeps pushing to change the focus of scientific research and roll back environmental regulations, moves that critics say favor industry over public health, members of North Carolina's scientific and environmental communities are speaking out. They're raising alarms about the effect of the EPA's stated goal of dismantling its environmental research arm, including the possible closure of its Office of Research and Development in Research Triangle Park. Elizabeth Beiser, former secretary of the NC Department of Environmental Quality, said in a text, gutting EPA's research capabilities directly harms states' ability to ensure we have clean air and clean water, because we rely on the EPA for scientific expertise and capacity that is rarely available at the state level. Eliminating the scientific backbone of the EPA would severely compromise the agency's ability to make evidence-based decisions, putting communities across North Carolina and the nation at risk. When you add funding cuts to scientific research at academic institutions, the nation as a whole is losing critical resources to protect the public from toxic chemicals. Critics warn that closing ORD's Research Triangle facility could jeopardize public health, hinder critical climate research, undermine environmental safeguards, and harm the economy of the Research Triangle and North Carolina as a whole. The Office of Research and Development opened its Research Triangle Park facility in 2001, and for more than two decades, it has played a pivotal role in advancing science that protects public health and the environment. The office's contribution includes developing tools to monitor air pollution, helping detect and manage PFAS contamination in North Carolina's drinking water, informing public health guidance during the COVID-19 pandemic, and engaging more than 380,000 students and community members through education and outreach programs. These contributions have shaped federal and state environmental policies while directly benefiting local communities, according to the agency. Chris Frey, a North Carolina State Engineering professor, former assistant administrator at ORD, said, ORD has also done a lot of the fundamental research to understand the health effects of exposure to air pollution. That includes work at a laboratory facility located on the campus of the University of North Carolina, where clinical studies of human exposure were conducted. Not long ago, the agency announced it was not going to continue funding that facility and is vacating the site. That is a significant loss of research capability that is very unique in the United States, actually, very unique globally. In addition to RTP, the Office of Research and Development maintains facilities across the country, including in Washington, D.C., New Jersey, Rhode Island, and Oregon. In recent years, its total staff has hovered around 1,500, with approximately 700 based at RTP, according to Fry, who returned to his NC State post in 2024. Of those 700, about 400 have departed recently through resignations, early retirements, or firings, he said. According to the most recent data published by EPA, the agency's RTP campus contributed, quote, an annual output of $240 million within the region and $260 million statewide. Linda Birnbaum, who was the director of the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, also in Research Triangle Park, from 2009 to 2019, said, the loss of so much expertise hurts everyone. In addition, the loss of hundreds of federal jobs is only the tip of the iceberg because all of those positions are accompanied by the loss of contractors, trainees, and visiting scientists. Huge economic as well as personal losses. In addition to the scientific research that has shed light on public health issues like COVID and PFAS, ORD has provided research opportunities for thousands of students from local universities, said Fry. Quote, the local universities in the area, try NC State, UNC, Duke, Central, and also others like North Carolina A&T, have had strong partnerships and collaborations with ORD and Research Triangle Park. There's a kind of research ecosystem that revolves around what goes on at that EPA lab, and that's all apparently coming to an end. Earlier this year, NC State University economist emeritus Mike Walden told NC Health News that a rule of thumb is to double the amount of a federal grant to get a handle on the ripple economic effect of that money on a region. Project dollars generate jobs for research assistants, needs for equipment and other capital investments. The people who fill those posts or supply that apparatus then spend money from the grant, generating local economic activity in grocery stores, restaurants, and retails. The Environmental Protection Network, a nonpartisan group that includes many former EPA employees, works to strengthen and protect environmental safeguards. Members warned that the Trump administration's efforts to reduce scientific research and roll back regulations will harm the U.S. population. EPN, the Environmental Protection Network, projects these rollbacks could lead to, quote, nearly 200,000 premature U.S. deaths through 2050 and trigger more than 10,000 asthma attacks each day nationwide, resulting in missed school and work days and increased emergency care. The group also estimates public health costs will outweigh corporate savings by 6 to 1, with about $250 billion in annual benefits lost, compared to $39 billion in reduced costs for polluters. Undermining protections under the Clean Air Act, Safe Drinking Water Act, and other laws. Although environmentalists are concerned about the potential loss of the Office of Research and Development and the rollback of regulations, Fry believes that the need for continued scientific research will not go away. And he says, in a sense, this is an exercise. By taking away this capability, it's going to cause people to realize what they're missing and how badly it is needed. So I would think it's going to motivate a really strong conversation about how we fulfill this need for new science to deal with increasingly complex challenges. Well, now for our major story, which is definitely related to the previous one I just read, by Lisa Sorg, originally published at Inside Climate News, and titled "A Test for Trump's EPA, a Creek That Smells Like Death." On the summer afternoon in Burton Park, hip-hop throbs from a car stereo over the backbeat of a basketball slapping on concrete. The sun bakes a grid of identical brick buildings whose wheezing window air conditioners can barely keep pace with the 96-degree heat. Three young boys laugh and shout as they speed down the sidewalk on their bikes. They stop and point at a creek. It lies stagnant behind an orange snow fence smothered in kudzu. "You can't go in there," one of the boys blurts. He pulls the collar of his T-shirt over his nose. "It stinks." 2 years ago, in August of 23, the city fenced off the creek in East Durham after chemical distribution company Brenntag Mid-South detected high levels of acetone, toluene, and ethanol in water at its property edge half a mile upstream. Early this year, Durham City Manager Bo Ferguson contacted Environmental Protection Agency's regional office in Atlanta for help. He wrote on February 12th that given the long history of industrial uses and contamination of the premises, we believe that the U.S. EPA is best equipped to collaborate with the city and Brenntag Mid-South to improve conditions. Initially, the EPA was alarmed by Ferguson's information, but 2 days after he sent his letter, EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin announced mass layoffs at the agency. Within a month, Zeldin had eliminated the Office of Environmental Justice and External Civil Rights, which had been expanded under President Joe Biden. The goal of that office was to better protect communities like McDougald's Terrace, which is bisected by the contaminated creek, from pollution and environmental harms, and to recognize that racism is at the heart of environmental injustice. Census data showed McDougald Terrace neighborhood is 99% black or Latino, 46% low income. It's unclear if the EPA under the Trump administration will assist Durham in addressing pollution at the Brenntag plant, and if so, to what extent. It will be an important test of EPA's willingness to hold polluters accountable under the Trump administration, especially as they impact environmental justice communities. EPA spokesman told Inside Climate News that the agency, quote, is continuing to coordinate with the city of Durham and NC Department of Environmental Quality to understand and evaluate options to address the city's environmental concerns at the Brenntag Mid-South facility, end quote. A Brenntag spokesperson told Inside Climate News the issues affecting the creek, quote, are complex and may be the result of multiple sources that are not yet known with certainty. Brenntag has taken numerous steps in close coordination with the city of Durham to help address these issues. Brenntag has maintained active communication with and to the city across status reports, meetings, and ad hoc communications since 2023, said a company spokesperson. This has included quarterly reports since June of 23, monthly reporting on water sampling since May of 24, additional ad hoc groundwater and surface reports, and numerous calls and meetings with city officials. Corey Lavati, a member of the Durham Environmental Affairs Board, which advises the city and county on environmental matters, says state and federal regulators must intervene, saying, Durham residents should know this is a serious pollution issue that is beyond the capacity of our local stormwater and water quality agencies. DEQ also bears some responsibility. For nearly 30 years, the agency failed to regulate stormwater discharge from the site, state emails show, even though it knew about the persistent pollution and risks to the downstream drinking water supply in Jordan Lake. State officials lost paperwork and at least twice failed to follow up with Brentag on missing information needed to complete its application. Meanwhile, city officials pleaded with the state for help. In 2008, John Cox, a water quality director with the city's stormwater division, told state regulators in an email, quote, "They must take a more active role in addressing issues at the site, including contaminated groundwater. Residents downstream have been severely impacted by the odor," he wrote. "This has become an environmental justice issue." The contamination at Brentag site has long plagued the neighborhood, even before the company bought its predecessor, South Chem, in 2001. Since at least the mid-1990s, high levels of at least a dozen chemicals have been detected in the groundwater and in stormwater runoff at the property. Under both owners, there have been spills. Inspectors have found dented, rusted, and leaking barrels of chemicals. State records show. Multiple years of samplings show contaminants have intermittently entered the creek, which runs through Burton Park, passes by an elementary school playground and a community recreation center. It skirts several homes and runs through McDougal Terrace, the oldest and largest public housing community in Durham. At times, as recently as April, city records show, pollution flowing from Brentag's outfalls has turned the water black, as if it were ink. A state environmental specialist wrote in 2004, "The creek often reeks. Smells have been so bad at times Durham police have been called in to look for dead bodies." The residents of McDougal, many of them children, are chronically exposed to pollution. They breathe diesel fumes from a major railroad and the Durham Freeway, which flank their neighborhood. They're exposed to hazardous air pollutants, particulate matter, and other harmful emissions from nearby industrial sources, according to state records. The area ranks among the top 5% in the state in terms of proximity to hazardous waste sites, federal data shows. Neighborhood residents live in a vulnerable zone, designated by EPA as being at risk of harm by chemical release from facilities that handle extremely hazardous substances. That includes Brentag. With around 75 employees, the Pettigrew site in Durham handles approximately 300 types of chemicals and ingredients that are classified as both non-hazardous and hazardous, including those classified as toxic, corrosive, cancer-causing, and flammable, state records show. Until last year, Brentag had two state permits, one for air and another regulating its groundwater treatment system. It did not have a state stormwater permit, which regulates runoff from the surface of a property. Such a permit contains limits on the types of and amounts of chemicals that can be released, among other requirements. Brentag did not receive one from the state until early 2024, more than two decades after it bought South Chem. Inside Climate News could find no evidence that South Chem ever had such a permit either. The reason why Brentag and its predecessor got a pass from the state are bewildering. In 1996, someone at the agency lost the application paperwork for a stormwater permit, emails show. In the early to mid-2000s, agency officials disagreed about the type of permit required. The company reapplied for a stormwater permit in 2005, but heard nothing, according to state emails. Brentag again applied for a stormwater permit in 2011. That's a requirement of a consent order with the state but the company did not update its application as the state requested, and the state did not follow up. That application lay dormant for 12 years. Until this year, the Division of Water Resources, which regulates the state's surface waters, including the creek, was, quote, unaware of the history of problems and wanted more information, unquote, according to a city presentation this spring to the Environmental Affairs Board. A DEQ spokesperson told Inside Climate News that DRW has since opened an investigation into Brenntag. Its staff conducted water quality sampling July the 24th at several locations, including immediately upstream of Burton Elementary and the park, for volatile organic compounds and other pollutants. Staff did not sample the main stem of the creek in McDougal Terrace, the spokesperson said, because it is fenced off. Brenntag is about a mile and a half from downtown Durham, across several pairs of railroad tracks from Old East Durham, a historic black neighborhood. The offices are in a long, two-story brick building with arched windows covered in red wood, remnants of its original use as a cotton mill and then a box factory. On a recent morning, a sign near the gate noted the company had gone 3,696 days without a lost time injury. Beyond metal gates and about 100 yards off Pettigrew Street lie a stretch of concrete buildings with a few notches for windows, giving the facility the appearance of a prison. A rail spur enters here where train cars ship millions of pounds of bulk chemicals to and from Brenntag each year, including sulfuric acid, epoxy, and solvents. Brenntag also receives, stores, and distributes non-bulk chemicals like ammonia and chloroform via truck. Because they routinely handle millions of pounds of hazardous chemicals each year, it must file paperwork with EPA under the agency's Risk Management Program, as well as with state and local emergency management officials. The company's most recent filing to the state for the 2024 reporting year spans 350 pages and itemizes the chemicals, qualities, and concentrations, as well as potential health effects depending on the level of exposure, cancer, eye and skin irritation, reproductive and respiratory harm, genetic mutations. Chemicals with those potential health hazards have been found in the groundwater at the Brenntag facility at levels hundreds of times higher than state standards, including cobalt, acetone, lead, and benzopyrene. Concentrations of a likely carcinogen, that's 1,4-dioxane, has been detected at 770 times what the state considers safe if it were to enter the creek. Acetone might be bypassing a remediation system, according to a publicly available report written in 2023 by a Brenntag environmental consultant. A subsequent report in 24 emphasized that further analysis was necessary to ensure, quote, off-site groundwater contamination is not spread to other nearby properties. This past January, Brenntag consultants posited that the source of the contaminants in the creek are most likely stormwater at the facility and groundwater infiltration. Contractors for the company theorized some of the contaminated groundwater is a legacy of the textile industry and predates Brenntag. From 1885 to 1937, long before there were federal and state regulations, the Durham Cotton Manufacturing Company used industrial lagoons and unlined landfills to hold and dispose of its waste. Removing the source of contamination is a widely accepted method of reducing or eliminating its spread. If Brenntag were to do that, though, it would likely be voluntary. City officials said DEQ told them the agency cannot legally require Brenntag to, quote, perform extra work to mitigate contamination from buried waste disposed of by the cotton mill. There have been several incidents in which Brenntag has mishandled chemicals which could contribute to the contaminated runoff. In March of 22, the state inspected the facility to determine whether it needed a stormwater permit. Some barrels that stored chemicals were lying on their side, inspection records show. Others were dented and, quote, an unknown liquid appeared to be leaking in the containment area. The inspector wrote, there didn't appear to be sufficient barriers or precautions to protect each chemical outside from being accidentally punctured, spilled, or otherwise released to the stormwater system. A permit is required, and an updated application package should be submitted as soon as possible. This past April, state inspectors visited Brenntag again in response to a complaint. They found old steel drums with rust that had compromised the container. Other drums weren't severely fastened or even properly closed. The inspector saw stains of caustic materials on the asphalt, possibly the result of spills, as the chemicals were being transferred via hoses from the rail car. The hoses were stored on the ground with caustic materials evident inside the ends and splashed on the asphalt. Regardless of the source, Brenntag is legally required to prevent or control contaminants from leaving its property. Brenntag retrofitted parts of the plant in 2010 under the consent order with the state. City officials repeatedly told Brenntag to investigate the discharge and shut off any conduits between the property and the creek, and the company finally did so last year. One afternoon this July, after 10 days of heat and no rain, the creek in Burton Park was barely more than a series of mosquito-infested puddles, disjointed by bars of silt. Empty beer cans littered the creek bed. During a historic drought in 2007, there was too little rainfall to dilute what was emanating from that plant. Cox, a water quality director with the city's stormwater division, wrote at the time, "The impacts to the stream and to water quality are unacceptable. The city has previously agreed to a phased approach to addressing this issue. Our patience with this approach is wearing thin, given the lack of progress and the horrible job of Brenntag communicating with the public. This has remained unsolved for far too long. It is not going to go away." McDougal Terrace was built from 1954 to 59, one of two then new segregated public housing complexes in the city. The community was in a redlined area, so named for the racially discriminatory federal maps that shaded the boundaries of black, immigrant, and poor neighborhoods in red and labeled them, quote, hazardous. The Federal Housing Administration would not back loans on properties in black neighborhoods because government officials believed home values would decline over the terms of the mortgage. Although the racist practice was outlawed in 1968, academic studies have shown decades of disinvestment have created inequalities that persist today. Nationwide, residents of formerly redlined neighborhoods are exposed to multiple environmental hazards and more pollution, the consequence of segregationist land use policies, according to a University of Michigan study released this year. And that trend is true in Durham. The neighborhoods near the Brenntag plant rank among the highest in the state for proximity and exposure to pollution sources. Hazardous waste facilities, underground petroleum storage tanks, cars, diesel trucks, and more, according to the EPA's EJ Screen tool. In the census block group containing Brenntag and McDougal Terrace, children's asthma hospitalization rates are four times the state average, according to public health data. Residents also have lower life expectancy and higher rates of heart disease. Most of the homes in the neighborhood were built before 1978, when the EPA outlawed lead-based paint for residential use. in the McDougal Terrace neighborhood. Not only could children be exposed to lead indoors, but also from the bed of the creek. Sampling from 2023 showed creek sediment contained lead. Although those levels were below the EPA's residential standard, there is no safe threshold for lead exposure. The EPA has set a goal of zero. After World War II and until 1985, Durham's predominantly white leadership enacted zoning policies to steer hazardous or polluting industries to the city's predominantly black east side, according to an analysis by Andrew Whitmore, an associate professor at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And he wrote, "The city council may have only been favoring industry's return to sections of the city where textile mills had long stood vacant. However, the new industries, unlike the mills, employed smaller workforces and were involved in hazardous uses, including chemical storage and manufacture. Within a mile of McDougal Terrace are two concrete plants, two scrap yards, at least five hazardous waste sites, including the remnants of now shuttered chemical companies, and a half dozen areas where oil or gasoline tanks have leaked or spilled, state data shows. Several chemical accidents have occurred in the neighborhood. In 2020, sulfuric acid from a rail car parked at Bentag sprayed on vehicles on the nearby Durham Freeway. One person had her window open and was hit in the face. The next year, a forklift driver at the plant accidentally hit a plastic container and spilled 5 to 10 gallons of hydrochloric acid. In 1983, a barrel of butyl acetate ruptured at Armageddon Chemicals, great name, just across the tracks from the current Brentag site, prompting an evacuation of hundreds of people. 3 years later, one of the most serious chemical accidents in the city occurred at Brentag's predecessor, SouthChem. Three tractor trailers carrying industrial chemicals exploded, according to media reports, and 600 families had to flee the immediate area, and a chemical cloud drifted over downtown. In early August, rain swelled this creek. Its current surged against the rocks, washed through an abandoned bicycle, and carried the empty beer cans downstream. Behind that snow fence and along the banks, a feral tangle of invasive plants, lady's thumb, mimosas, and tree of heaven, glistened with raindrops. When the city initially cordoned off the creek, officials posted signs in Spanish and English warning parkgoers not to wade and play in the water. But after 2 years, those placards are gone. At the McDougal Terrace office, people behind the service counter said they weren't aware of the contamination. One person didn't even know a creek existed. The city is still awaiting word from the EPA. Meanwhile, the city officials cited Brentag in June for illegally discharging an excess flow of stormwater and failing to complete corrective actions from violations issued 3 years ago. A city spokesperson told Inside Climate News, quote, "We are exploring all legal and regulatory options." Since 2022, the state and city have fined Brentag just $3,500 for its discharges. Last year, the company recorded gross profits of more than $4 billion, according to investor statements. Levati of the Environmental Affairs Board says Brentag needs to be held more accountable for the pollution associated with this facility. On August the 4th, Durham City Council approved spending up to $400,000 on a consultant to track pollutants in two creeks, including the one in Burton Park, to their source. The money would also cover expenses for public outreach, according to this contract. City Councilman Nate Baker told Inside Climate News, quote, "Residents living around Burton Park have lived with decades of underinvestment, environmental injustice, and industrial encroachment. We cannot tolerate this any longer. A leak of toxins into the creek running through the park must stop, and the creek must be remediated as quickly as possible, with those responsible paying for the costs they have already levied on the community. Over to Raleigh now, and another type of pollution, noise pollution. The city of Raleigh has been struggling with regulating noise since you could buy a cup of coffee for a dollar at the morning times or even before. And last week, a Wake County Superior Judge ruled that parts of the city's nightlife permit ordinance, that's a separate but related regulation from the noise ordinance, are illegal after a local bar owner sued the city over it. But even before that judgment came down, officials were considering making changes to the turn down the sound rules, and the city is taking public comments for help with the process. Julia Milstead, a spokesperson for the city of Raleigh, told Indy the ruling on the nightlife ordinance, quote, does not impact the engagement we've been doing regarding the noise ordinance. In 2023, after much debate, Raleigh adopted new rules to rein in noise and disruptive partying, mainly in downtown's entertainment districts, including Glenwood South. The rules, which went into effect in February of 24, required a $500 initial fee for nightlife permits for businesses selling drinks and providing entertainment after 11 p.m., and a renewal fee annually of $100. Additionally, establishments that received noise citations had to, quote, stop outdoor amplified sound for 24 hours and pay a $500 fine for a first offense, a $2,500 fine for a second offense, and $5,000 for a third. Business owners complained about being unfairly targeted after the new rules, since they only applied to businesses with a nightlife permit. Don Lovenheim, who owns several bars on Glenwood South, including Alchemy, The Avenue, and Milk Bar, filed a lawsuit against the city in February of last year. Along with the adoption of the nightlife permit, the city amended its noise ordinance to require commercial establishments that receive noise citations to be measured by a, quote, reasonable person standard rather than a specific decibel level. Then in January, the city strengthened the rules to enforce turning down the sound. Businesses had to comply or risk another citation, with their only recourse being to appeal that citation to the city manager's office rather than the police department. On Thursday, Judge Paul Holcomb III issued an order saying the city's nightlife permit ordinance conflicted with the state's ABC laws, writing that requiring nightlife permits is, quote, unlawful, invalid, and void, as being without authority and inconsistent with the preemptive uniform system of regulation of ABC permittees, unquote, and that parts of the ordinance are illegal, void, and unenforceable under state law. Milstead wrote to the Indy in an email, since receiving the order, the city has taken steps necessary to comply while it considers all options. The city is assessing adjustments to the nightlife ordinances to address the concerns as well as other potential options. The Indy requested data from the Raleigh Police Department about how many noise complaints the city has received and where in 2025, and we will update this story when we receive that. At a city council work session last May, the city's leaders received a sociable city assessment report from an independent consultant called the Responsible Hospitality Institute about how it could improve its noise policy. That report, commissioned in early 2024 and focused specifically on the downtown district around Fayetteville Street and Glenwood South, seemed to strike a chord with the mayor and some council members. In that report, the consultants suggested revising the noise ordinance and using a third-party mediator to facilitate a new community engagement process between the city and business community. Quote, between which lies a chasm of mistrust, states the report. It suggests potentially exploring an alternative enforcement agency or civilian entity, i.e. not the police department, to be in charge of noise enforcement, revisiting that reasonable person standard, and implementing a citywide 311 phone system for tracking complaints. And finally, it states creating a, quote, night manager position and an office of nighttime economy. And it has become the gold standard in North America to ensure long-term sustainability. Raleigh Mayor, said Janet Cowell at the city's Safe, Vibrant, and Healthy Communities Committee meeting later that month. When I read the Sociable City study, it said a paradigm shift is required. Everything in that report resonated to me that that is the right approach. Council members agreed to give city staff time to come up with actionable recommendations on the issue, potentially this month, after the council members return from their summer break. Meanwhile, the city launched its online survey August the 1st. There's currently no end date, but city staff will eventually report back to the council and get further direction on any continued engagement efforts, according to Milstead. And I have some little bit of time left, about 10 minutes. Joseph DeCosimo makes old-time music that brings people together, writes Sarah Edwards. When Joseph DeCosimo was 16, his dad drove him from Chattanooga, Tennessee, to Warren Wilson's College, famed Swannanoa Gathering, and dropped him off. The annual Folk Music and Arts Conference wasn't his first rodeo. DeCosimo had been toying with the banjo since seventh grade, but he stood out in a room of adults. A Greensboro musician, Steve Terrell, saw him and asked where he'd rolled in from. DeCosimo recalls Terrell saying, "There are a few people around where you live that you could just go and hang out with." He pulled out a Rolodex and jotted down the name of a few old-time musicians in Tennessee's Cumberland Plateau area. One of them, Charlie Acuff, an octogenarian fiddler and incidentally cousin to Roy Acuff, a.k.a. the King of Country Music, became somewhat of a mentor to the high schooler. And he says, "My dad had got me a tape recorder." He's recalling his visits to learn from and document Acuff's music. "I was stumbling into being like a folklorist just by sheer interest in the music in East Tennessee. The first time I visited him, he gave me a tape," he continues. "It was called Left-Handed Fiddler, because he was a left-handed fiddler, and I went home and just, like, learned every tune on it." On August the 15th, that is tomorrow by my calendar, Friday, his latest album, Fiery Gizzard, releases via the Philadelphia-based label Dear Life Records. As with previous albums, this release draws on a deep catalog of fiddle and banjo standards from throughout the Appalachian South, scything old sounds through playful new input and a generative community sensibility. We're talking on DeCosimo's screened-in front porch, surrounded by the ever-present pitch of summer bugs. Not surprisingly, it's a space he and his banjo have spent plenty of time in. And he says, "In order for our kid to sleep at night, this is where you end up sweating it out, sitting and messing with stuff and coming up with new ideas." Years after his trip to Swannanoa, a few things have changed. DeCosimo, 43, is now a longtime resident of Durham, with a family and a trifecta of degrees from UNC Chapel Hill, including a folklore Ph.D. But he's still a musician, tangling with the sounds of the past. That long-ago moment of Rolodex kismet led not just to a friendship with Acuff, but down the road to years of study with old-time virtuoso Clyde Davenport, a fellow native of the Cumberland Plateau. Davenport, who died in 2020, is responsible for preserving a vast repertoire of regional music that De Cosimo in kind now passes on to students and fellow musicians. The album Fiery Gizzard follows two solo albums and several collaborative projects. This album, as De Cosimo tells it, was largely inspired by the musician he regularly jams with, about half of whom are local. On the album, that bill rounds out with the much sought-after fiddler Steph Coleman, Nora Brown, guitarist Jay Hammond, multi-instrumentalist Matthew O'Connell, bassist and producer Andy Stack of Wyoak, horn player Kelly Pratt, Beirut and David Byrne, Libby Rodenbaugh, Mipso and Fust, and Joseph O'Connell, Elephant Micah, and the experimental artist Cleek Schrey. And De Cosimo says, the process came out of playing with people and seeing what old tunes made sense in these different configurations. What was the material we could sink into and jam in a way that was responsive and not thoughtless? That attunement comes through on Fiery Gizzard like a live wire, as the album shifts comfortably between tracks anchored by vocals, such as I Had a Good Father and Mother, Billy Button, and others, that descend into a hypnotic superlunar swarm of instrumentals like Glory in the Meeting House, Shady Grove. The winsome, meandering Punchin Camps is a tune that De Cosimo learned from Davenport. From the outside, old-time music, cerebral, layered, specialized, can sometimes feel intimidating. But in the same way that the jam format is hospitably responsive, those layers of history have the capacity to call even the most uninformed layperson in. Music that has history is a gift. It's nearly impossible, for instance, to listen to an album like this without being sent down discursive rabbit holes. Throw on Fiery Gizzard, and the next thing you'll know, it's 2 a.m., and you've got 17 Angel Fire tabs pulled up that spell out, in some shaky papyrus font, the legends of the past. Take the influence the album draws from the bluesman Abner Jay, an outsider musician born in 1921 who preached his The Percussive Gospel of Cow and Chicken Bones and other musical traditions inherited from his grandfather, Louis W. Jay, born enslaved in Washington County, Georgia, that he made singular through a fearlessly funky consciousness. The Abner Jay aesthetic, as De Cosimo puts it, comes through on tracks like Flowery Girls, which were recorded with the assistance of a pickup rigged inside a fretless banjo and transmitted through a tube amp. He says, if you listen to the record, you can hear a conversation that is living and breathing in a way. We're not working from a score. We are working from maybe a sense of energy, the build and release of something. Then there's Shady Grove, one of the album's more well-known Appalachian standards. You can find popular Doc Watson and Billy Strings versions of it online, though the Fiery Gizzard rendition is closer kin to the droning vernacular of Southwest Virginian fiddler Luther Davis, who, for his part, was born in 1887 and passed on many of his songs through Durham's Alice Gerard. The album steps into the current century with a gently loping The Queen of Rocky Ripple, which Durham's Joseph O'Connell released many years ago as part of his Elephant Micah project. It's the only contemporary song that De Cosimo has ever recorded, but you'd be forgiven for not noticing. Like the other material on Fiery Gizzard, it seems to occupy the hinterlands where past and present converge. And De Cosimo says, a lot of times people think of traditional music as museum set pieces, you know, a cosplay of the past. I don't think that that's what the nature of the music is. It's exploratory. There's a form that you're working with, but you're exploring, taking different turns. and seeing where it takes you. And my final story, which you will have to cut way short, I wanted to mention about the Lakewood do-it-yourself skate park, which is ramping up there over in Durham. Mark Hanley, rocking a grease-stained button down that suggests an adeptness with power tools, is gripping the handle of the drill. He points out patches of poison ivy lurking along a fence near a skateboard ramp, a gesture much appreciated by everyone in proximity. If you ever want to know for sure, it's always got three leaves and a thumb, he says. When it's giving you a thumbs up, it's going, I'm Poison Ivy. What's up, buddy? Come hang out with me, and you're supposed to go. No, bad Poison Ivy. How dare you tempt me with your cool guy thumbs up? Hanley, a lifelong skateboarder, is one of a handful of tenacious volunteers who gathered under the beating sun this weekend at the old outdoor skate park near Wheels. They're here to disassemble the unused mini ramp that will anchor Lakewood's future do-it-yourself skate park. DIY projects like this, Hanley says, are the basis of the skate community. In the spring, the city of Durham authorized Parks and Rec to donate leftover skate park materials to the scrap exchange that the city acquired when it purchased Wheels in 2020. Saturday was the first time Johnson and others could get on site to start working on one of Durham's most unique recycling jobs. Getting that mini ramp taken apart and reassembled was top priority. Johnson says it's going to be the first public mini ramp in Durham and in the Triangle ever, so that's going to be awesome. And we might set it up in that garden area temporarily so it'll be more featured. Roller skaters in Durham often have to travel to neighboring communities like Apex, Chapel Hill, and Cary to find parks that can accommodate them, not because the people in the Durham community aren't as welcoming as others, but the limited real estate for street and park skating makes it a challenge to accommodate the varying ways that people enjoy rolling around. Well, and speaking of rolling around, I've got to be rolling on out of here, get home, but you can be pretty sure that I'll be back in a week, John Feddersen, that is to say, reading the next issue of Indie Week, The Independent. And this program, which is a podcast, is broadcast one time, Friday afternoons, and then it exists as a podcast if you want to rehear any articles. But Indie Week, reminding you, can be found online with all these articles and plenty more that I don't have time to get to. So for the North Carolina Reading Service, thanks all for listening to The Independent. So long.